Hi, I'm Danielle Kading, and you're listening to Hear Me Out on Wisconsin Public Radio. Thanks for being with us on this Friday. This week, President Donald Trump released his plan to stop opioid abuse. And during a stop in northern Wisconsin, Attorney General Brad Schimmel offered mixed views on the president's initiative, which would include stricter sentences for drug traffickers, including the death penalty. President Trump's plan would allow the U.S. Department of Justice to seek the death penalty against traffickers of fentanyl and other opioids. State Attorney General Brad Schimmel says that won't stop drug abuse.
As long as that demand exists, people are going to supply this. And I make no bones about it. I'm a pro-life person. And that also causes me to not think the death penalty is an appropriate solution to anything. We've got better ways.
Schimmel wants to see expanded treatment resources. Trump's plan does include expanding access to medication-assisted treatment for opioids in every state. The president's initiative would also cut back prescription of opioid painkillers by a third within 3 years. Schimmel says the state has sought to cut back on overprescribing through strict guidelines from Wisconsin's Medical Examining Board. Meth, not opioid abuse, was the heart of the Attorney General's Law Enforcement Roundtable session in Ashland County this week. County officials and police shared their struggles to keep up with rising costs, caseloads, and out-of-home child care as the result of meth abuse. When Kelly McKnight became the Ashland County District Attorney in 2011, his office filed 122 felonies for the whole year. Just this week, McKnight says he filed his 83rd felony for 2018.
So we've already passed the tripling of our felony caseload, and we're working on moving on toward quadrupling our felony caseload.
McKnight says the reason is the number of people who have been caught using or holding meth, which is an automatic felony. He says it's the same story anytime they deal with opioids.
Whether it's OxyContin or hydrocodone in, you know, opioid pill form, or whether it's heroin or fentanyl, which we're seeing an increase in.
His caseload and others are being driven by drug cases and the crimes that go along with them. Child protection cases have also grown in the county, according to Terry Barningham with Ashland County Health and Human Services.
Almost all of the reports we're receiving now, we're screening in, and they're serious, and we are having to remove children. So I think the amount of children in placement has almost doubled from a year ago. The majority of those cases are all drug-related.
The cost to the county for placing children in out-of-home care has nearly doubled since 2016 to roughly $720,000 last year. Barningham says parents will often seek treatment after a child is removed from the home, but she says it's not long before they fall off their radar.
They will disappear. We know they're using again. Some parents we can't even locate. They just disappear for months on end. So then you can't do any of the work to try to make them better parents so you can reunite.
Barningham says parents who take part in the county's drug treatment court have more supervision and are more successful. McKnight says meth is the drug of choice for 18 of their 25 active drug court participants. But he says even successful graduates have ended up back in the courtroom.
The meth people just seem to keep coming back.
Ashland County Sheriff McBrennan says it's often the same story with inmates they house in the Ashland County Jail.
We've seen many, many times talk about treatment. People have gone into treatment for 30, 45, 60 days. They come out, and I would say the vast majority are reusing or being charged again within a very short time, week to a month, back in jail because they're using again.
Brennan says he'd like to see more education among kids to help break the cycle of drug abuse in families. Ashland Police Chief Jim Gregwire agrees.
So why are we not increasing the school day by 15 minutes and doing nothing but prevention? I realize it costs money, but like Sheriff Brennan said, this is a generational thing, and what they're seeing in their homes, dirty diapers laying on the floor, needles laying around, meth pipes hanging around, that's normal to them. And it's really ticking me off that there's nothing we can do.
Barningham says the county has a coalition on emerging drugs that's been examining ways to prevent drug use.
We've been looking into mentoring programs, working with the school on some of their programs that they're using with the AWARE grant, and looking actively for grants because we don't have any funding, because all of our funding is going to put out the fires that we currently have.
Ashland County Administrator Jeff Burrell agrees. He says they've seen a $750,000 increase in public safety spending over the last 3 years.
Health and Human Services, it's been the last 2 years. In 16, it was $330,000. I think in 2017, it's almost $250,000. We are playing games with the budget. We're borrowing and raising our debt levy service.
This month, the Ashland County Board approved a resolution to seek a $1 million increase in the county's operating levy. Burrell says they'll put a referendum before voters for their approval in August. Even if voters sign off on it, he says the majority of that money would only go to cover the mounting costs now facing the county due largely to drug abuse. The Ashland County Board also approved a resolution this month to reject a $9.5 million wrongful death claim from the parents of Jason Pirro. The 14-year-old was shot and killed by Ashland County Sheriff's Deputy Brock Marjanovich on the Bad River Reservation last November. The Wisconsin Department of Justice and the deputy say Pirro lunged twice at the officer with a knife. A St. Croix County prosecutor found the fatal shooting was justified following an investigation by the state. A claim is often a precursor to a lawsuit against a government body. The boy's parents, Holly Gauthier and Jason Pirro, have a six-month window to file a lawsuit against the county. The parents allege the state and sheriff's department failed to properly train the deputy in the use of deadly force. We're going to take a short break for these announcements, and when we come back, we'll hear from Superior Police Chief Nick Alexander about a decision to give back an armored military vehicle to the U.S. Army. Later in the program, we'll hear from Keith Kessler and Danny Miller with Douglas County about efforts to bring 911 service into the digital age. I'm Danielle Kading, and you're listening to Hear Me Out on Wisconsin Public Radio. Danielle Kading, and you're listening to Hear Me Out on Wisconsin Public Radio. This week, the Superior City Council approved the purchase of an emergency operations vehicle for the Superior Police Department. The vehicle would replace a mine-resistant ambush-protected vehicle, or MRAP, that was given to the city on loan from the U.S. Army. Superior Mayor Jim Payne says it's an effort to demilitarize the department and use equipment that's more appropriate for police.
I've generally supported the demilitarization of the police and ensuring that we have a community-based civilian police force that focuses on relationships, but also highly trained tactical and crisis intervention techniques so that we can de-escalate situations whenever possible, but are prepared for dangerous situations as well. So that was the spirit of getting the MRAP in the first place, protect police officers in sensitive emergencies or highly dangerous crises.
Superior Police Chief Nick Alexander spoke with me by phone about the decision to send the vehicle back to the military and how they came to use it several years ago.
You know, we acquired it under the previous chief's legesse, so it was sometime 5 to 6 years ago, and it filled a need. At the time, our department didn't have an emergency operations vehicle that could provide ballistic protection to our officers and, you know, enhance capabilities for tactical emergency situations. The county has a vehicle that we had access to. However, it's stored nearly an hour away. So these incidents, you know, they are emergencies because they happen and they're not predicted often. And, you know, although that was a great asset to have, it really wasn't practical for our needs. So
what kind of situations have you used this vehicle in?
Well, typically our emergency response team, you know, which a lot of people would consider SWAT, we call it ERT, responds to types of calls that have a higher likelihood for violence, use of firearms, you know, possible injury or assault to the community or officers. So typical calls would be sometimes if we have a person who's barricaded in a home who's saying that they're armed, could be because they're maybe they're going to potentially talking about harming themselves, but or others. We've had situations where we've had a person in a house, and then there's other people. They don't necessarily have to be hostages, but other innocent people in the building. So those type of barricaded gunmen ones are. Search warrants, oftentimes drug search warrants, where there's some advanced intelligence that indicates that there's a greater likelihood that there's going to be firearms encountered. Those are probably some of our better examples. We'd use the vehicle on if we got calls for suspicious packages, because it's, you know, obviously can be used kind of as a shield as well, you know, if there's a suspected explosive device. Those are kind of, I think, you know, some of the better examples of when it would be used. The city of Superior, that happens probably, you know, 6 to 10 times a year.
Okay. When's the last time you had to use it?
Well, I'm not 100% sure, but it's I think it's possible it was used last night. I haven't spoken to the emergency response team commander today yet, but we did do a couple warrants related to the kidnapping incident earlier in the week, and there were weapons involved in that incident, so I think it's possible that the vehicle was used last night.
So if you've used it, you know, 6 to 10 times a year, why do you feel like it's a good idea to get rid of it or exchange it for this emergency operations vehicle?
Sure. Well, one, it is a military piece of equipment. I mean, it came from the Army. These types of vehicles serve in combat situations and, you know, in wars and other conflicts that, you know, that we're involved in as a country. It's incredibly large. You know, I don't know what it weighs, but it's a very obvious piece of equipment when you see it on the road. I mean, it's extremely high, wide, heavy. They're older ones that the military's provided to law enforcement, and there isn't a wide availability of parts for them. So we find that when it does break down, which has been often, that it's difficult to troubleshoot and find repairs. If it's an actual part that's broken, sometimes we have to have it fabricated or have a difficult time locating it. There's been times where it just hasn't started. You know, we live in a cold climate, and even though it's kept in an indoor garage, it's not heated, so there's been issues with that. We do plug it in, and that's helped. So there's been those types of problems. Then it's they weren't designed for cities, so, I mean, I think it causes unnecessary wear and tear on our roads. When you look at the ways that we use a vehicle like that on an emergency operation, a lot of times if we have somebody who's barricaded or you know, taking cover inside a residence or a structure, we would like to oftentimes get this vehicle close because we can use it as a base to establish communications and that type of stuff with and still provide protection to our officers. And when we're talking a vehicle of this size, I mean, just thousands and thousands of tons, it's causing additional property damage when we drive it off of the roads onto lawns and so on. That isn't necessary. And, I mean, you look at it and, I mean, I think for most people see it on a road and, you know, they're wondering if a military convoy is coming to town. I don't think it's the typical piece of equipment that communities would associate with their police department. And there are more readily available options. And as I said when I started, I mean, it served a purpose. It filled a hole that we didn't have in terms of coverage for our department 5-6 years ago when we got it. And we didn't have funding to be able to purchase a more appropriate vehicle that was designed specifically for civilian law enforcement. But since I've been chief, that's been something that I've been looking for, alternatives to it. One, because you know, I think there's difficulties with it in terms of its longevity and service and maintenance and the cost of keeping it, even though it was free. It's not free in the sense of maintaining it and keeping it. And I heard from citizens that, you know, they didn't view it as an appropriate piece of equipment for the police department, that they thought it was, you know, we were overdoing things when we'd have that type of vehicle out. I had veterans talk about how, you know, they've been deployed, they've used these things, and, you know, they view them as equipment for the military and for uses in war. And I've even had some that said, you know, it was a trigger for PTSD. When we did our community survey, that was something that a few people responded to, you know, why do you have a piece of military hardware on the department? So I've been looking for, you know, alternatives. I didn't want to give it up because it did fill a gap, you know, that we needed. But I did want to look to getting a more appropriate vehicle, and we ultimately were able to secure funding from the state of Wisconsin. They provided us a $250,000 grant to purchase a civilian emergency operation vehicle that's designed specifically for use for police departments, you know, in our communities. It's much smaller. It's more consistent in size to armored car vehicles for, you know, banks and so on that, you know, transport money. It's on a Ford frame with Ford powertrain. It can be serviced at the, you know, at Bena Ford here in Superior. It has a 10-year warranty, and in general, I think is a better reflection of our agency. So that's why I'm excited to get the new one.
So you think this will go a long way towards like community relations and building trust too?
I do. I mean, I think for some people, I certainly don't think it's everybody out there that, you know, was offended or thought that the MRAP was inappropriate. But I do think for others that, you know, it does, you know, to some people, you know, maybe creates an image more of a police state versus, you know, a free society like we are. I mean, that's people's personal opinions, how they come to those conclusions. But in the end, I do feel there are more appropriate alternatives out there. And once we were able to find a way to fund it, that was the direction I wanted to go.
So when will the MRAP go back to the Army?
We won't return it to them until the new vehicle is delivered to us, which likely won't be till the end of 2018 or maybe even very early 2019, but likely before the end of this year. And at that point, we'll notify the military that we no longer want it. We do have the option to transfer it to another law enforcement agency. So, you know, there is a system in Wisconsin where you can send out information to all of the agencies in the state that, hey, here's a piece of equipment that we're looking to get rid of. So if another agency seems that it will be something that, you know, works for them, that'll be an option too. But when the new one arrives, this one will go away one way or the other.
Again, that was Superior Police Chief Nick Alexander talking about a decision this week to buy an emergency operations vehicle for the department in exchange for the armored vehicle on loan from the Army. We're going to take a short break for these announcements, but when we come back, we'll speak with Douglas County's Danny Miller and Keith Kessler about efforts to upgrade 911 service. I'm Danielle Kading, and you're listening to Hear Me Out on Wisconsin Public Radio. I'm Danielle Kading, and you're listening to Hear Me Out on Wisconsin Public Radio. Within the next month, the state plans to send out surveys to 911 call centers across Wisconsin. State emergency communications officials are looking for information to guide the development of an emergency services internet network. That network would connect all the 911 call centers in the state and allow them to receive text messages and videos. Danny Miller is the Communications Center Supervisor for Douglas County 911, and Keith Kessler is the county's Director of Emergency Management. The two sat down with me recently to talk about the network upgrade and challenges facing 911 call centers statewide.
Over the years, we've done upgrades to our system as equipment needed to be refreshed, and currently we do have a 911 system in our county that will handle what's called next-gen 911. The biggest issue we have is that we can't get the next gen 911 data delivered to us so we can use it. There's been a long effort to try to get proper funding for 911 systems in the state of Wisconsin. There's been numerous committees and a legislative council that I served on that made recommendations to the state on how to fund it, but due to budgets and politics, some of that has been sitting on the back burner for some time. More recently, the Joint Finance Committee made a motion called Motion 50, and it turned into an act, and right off the top of my head, I don't remember that act number, that is actually implementing some of the things that came out of the Legislative Council that I served on about 4 or 5 years ago. It's going to put a fee on all devices that will call 911, cellular, landline, voice over IP, and any future devices. And it's going to fund an emergency service internet, an ESINet it's called, that will be available for any 911 center that chooses to attach to it. There's a lot of unknowns yet. It's anticipated that that ESINet will be paid for in its entirety by fees on phone users, but there is nothing in this process that's going to pay for equipment for like our back room or any other back room at this point. At some point we're hoping that some of that will be turned into a grant of some type to pay for equipment locally and to help pay for the cost of training our dispatchers. Now, one of the best things that came out of that action is that a 911 commission, well, actually, Bureau of Communications was formed. First time in the state that that's happened. And that Bureau of Communications is in charge of the 911 project and the ESINet. Land Mobile Radio, which is the use of tactical communications channels. WISCOM, which is the statewide infrastructure for our statewide communication system. And FirstNet, which will be a public safety wireless network for law enforcement, fire, or again, you know, the emergency service people that want to use it. And in the process of doing that, they also wrote in there that there should be a 19-member panel that will be helping to provide guidance to the Interoperability Council on how to move this forward. And that council members were appointed by the governor, and we were very fortunate to have Danny Miller, who is our supervisor in our 911 center, to be appointed to that committee.
Can you talk about your role, Danny, on the committee?
I'm actually serving on the committee, not for not representing Douglas County, but I'm actually representing the Wisconsin APCO chapter, which is the Association of Public Safety Communications. But I think on there, also representing APCO, representing the smaller agencies in the state. The overall goal of that committee and what we want is to create standardization across the board, across the state, with equipment, training, staffing, anything that centers need on a daily operational basis is the overall goal of that.
Can you talk at all about some of the challenges that smaller agencies are facing?
I think the biggest is funding. You know, local governments with purchasing of equipment. If every county has to buy their own phone system, that's a major purchase that can cost hundreds of thousands of dollars. The maintenance of the equipment, the upkeep of everything. I don't know.
Staff training would be a big thing. Mm-hmm. Right now, the inconsistencies in the service provided by the various 911 centers throughout the state is pretty significant. In our center, we provide pre-arrival instructions on emergency medical calls so that we have a dispatcher that stays on the phone with the caller, providing guidance based on a system that we have in place on how to provide care to the person that's having the problem. You get to a lot of smaller centers where there's only one dispatcher. It's very difficult for them to do that. They're trying to figure out how that can be implemented. They're trying to, I think they're going to try to come up with a level of training that's required. There may be some certifications involved. There's so many things being talked about that it's almost hard to cover everything. It's right now, the arena is wide open as far as what will be included. Now, one of the things to keep in mind with this committee, it's not just people directly involved with running 911 centers. There's actually a member on there, possibly two from phone companies. There's people from sheriffs, Badger State Sheriffs. I believe there's people on there from the League of Municipalities. We have a regional planning person on there.
There's emergency management representative. There's EMS representative.
Tried to cover every area that has something to do with either the implementation, the management of, or services received from 911 centers. And at the end of the day, which will probably be a long, long day, mounting into years, that norm or standard is going to be established, and hopefully they will come up with a method of funding so that all centers can provide a uniform type service to the citizens, so that what you get in Milwaukee can be the expectation any place in the state.
So it's not just about Next Gen 911, and maybe I should take a step back and kind of explain that. Basically, Next Generation 911 is upgrading the phone network so that emergency management officials and call centers can receive text messages and digital communications? Or can you explain exactly what it would do?
Right now, we're driving the Model T. Our phone lines are copper or fiber. The capacity of what they can deliver to us is somewhat limited. It's like having a pipe that's 2 inches in diameter, and we need a pipe that's 12 inches in diameter. The ESINet will be that 12-inch diameter pipe that will be able to carry more data, more information, and provide us with what we need in order to receive text messages, in order to receive photographs, possibly video, and whatever the future brings. They're trying to do this in a manner that it doesn't take care of yesterday, it's going to take care of what might come tomorrow.
It sounds like the challenges are funding, but there was $7 million, I believe. Is it $7 million that was?
A little less than seven. I don't remember the exact number, but it's a little under seven.
A little less than $7 million that was put into the last budget to build out this emergency services network, and that the issue is really the cost to counties to contract with phone companies to be able to do this sort of thing or to build out that infrastructure? Or
well, currently counties, and well, there's more than just the counties. There are some individual cities and things that also have PSAPs or public safety answering points. At this time, the charge on your phone bill is supposed to cover the cost of bringing the message from the wall of your house to our dispatch center wall. And the county has to pay for everything else. The problem is that in many counties, with the drop in landline phones, the revenue has fell so short that the phone companies have come and said, we're no longer getting enough money directly on the phone bills to cover this, so you have to dig into your pockets. So, for example, Bayfield County is paying something over $40,000 a year in addition to what had been on the phone bills in order to operate their 911. Now with this new legislation and with things changing, hopefully that problem will subside and go away for people that will at least get the phone up to our wall. What you have to consider is right now 80, maybe 85% of our calls are coming in wireless phones, and in the past they haven't paid a cent. There was a 3-year period where we had some special funding on the phones to make it so that we could receive the lat-long type information from a wireless phone. But that funding had a 3-year period, and it is sunsetted, so there's nothing else there.
You're not getting the funding you need from wireless phone users to pay for 911 service.
That's correct. We are paying to have 911 wireless delivered to us. And this ESINet and the funding for the ESINet hopefully will alleviate that payment.
Because the state will pay for it through this under
the 7 million?
The
phone company will pay for it. Not the phone company, the phone users will pay for it. Right now there's a lot of confusion. People look at their phone bill and they see a 75-cent police and fire fee. And then they see a charge for 911 and think, I'm being charged twice. Currently, and the way it's been in the past, none of the police and fire fee went directly for 911 service. Only the 911 charge did. Originally, that 75 cents was supposed to replace the local 911 charge, so that you'd see a 75-cent 911 fee, and that fee was going to provide the network that we needed, and it was intended to maybe leave a little extra money for some grants for paying for equipment and training. Well, a previous governor actually line item vetoed some critical words in the legislation. When the Legislative Council made that proposal and moved it forward to joint finance, the state of Wisconsin was in some pretty significant financial straits. And joint finance, I believe it was, decided that they would use that 75 cents to offset some cuts that they were planning to do with shared revenue. So that money's been going into the general fund and then supporting cuts in shared revenue. We lobbied pretty hard as a state organization to say, hey, we really need that money. So they put a two-year sunset on it, meaning that after 2 years, that money would then all go to 911 centers or to provide service for 911 centers, provide the information. That hit the governor's desk, and he drew a line through the two-year sunset. So ever since, that has all been going to the general fund. It's just, people just don't understand that part. Now, the proposals under the current legislation and what's taking place right now is a piece of that money is going to be used to help support the funding for this ESINET, but in return it's being backfilled so that people, the 75 cents isn't lost in the shared revenue side, if that makes any sense to you.
So basically that money is going to be used for its intended purpose originally, but the money will go back into the general fund to offset cuts to shared revenue.
Yeah, some of the logic behind it was if we put it in shared revenue is used to fund police departments and fire departments and sheriff's departments. So if the local community chooses to use their shared revenue to support 911, that's fine. In my mind, it was sort of a shell game, legal. You could put some logic to it, but it wasn't the original intent to come out of the Legislative Council when that happened. Now with what's happening, they're starting to get it back around. Now the whole 75 cents is not going to come to 911. A portion of it will, and I just don't have the numbers. I don't know what that's going to be yet. It's going to be decided at higher pay grade than ours.
Okay. Well, Danny, how are things going right now with Douglas County's 911 call center? Like, what are some of the challenges that you're seeing?
I think our biggest challenge always has been staffing. I think equipment-wise, we've set ourselves up really well. I mean, Keith talked earlier about our redundancy that we have with our equipment, but on a day-to-day basis, it's staffing that is our biggest issue. There's a statistic somewhere that I heard 2% of society can be a 911 dispatcher. The pool that we have to select from up here can be a little thin sometimes, so even to get 2% of any of our applicants is a struggle sometimes.
Because it's a really stressful and demanding job, and yes. I imagine you see some turnover with that.
Yeah, and most of our turnover really is with our training position, just to get them up to speed and be able to function in the comm center and take the calls and talk on the radio and understand what the police officers need from them and what the citizens need from them on the phone before anybody gets there. It is stressful. There's skills that I don't know how to interview and to test for skills like that. But once we do get somebody in the door and they work here, we've had pretty good success and have staff that has been here for 20 plus years, but there seems to be a constant struggle to get new fresh dispatchers in there that want to do it, even if they can do it, if they want to do it.
The staffing issue isn't unique to us. It's a nationwide problem. Mm-hmm. Because of the stress, a lot of people that actually can do the job can't do the job, because once they find out what it's really about, they can't stand it. They can't stand the calls that they hear. They can't stand the language that is spoken to them by some of the callers that are under the influence of various things. If I remember correctly, the last time I looked, there's approximately a 22% turnover in dispatch staff annually nationwide. That doesn't count the trainees that you're rolling through trying to find someone that will stay. That's seasoned people who are saying enough or have retired or whatever. And that's a very, very high rate of turnover. And there is no one that has come up with a silver bullet to stop that turnover issue.
Well, so you're not seeing the maintenance issue or, like, just the equipment, because you've had the equipment for 911 for, what is it, 5 years now?
Yeah, our next-gen equipment has been in place. We're at the end of the fifth year, and we are just in the process of negotiating, refreshing our computers and things like that, and that will carry us through for another 5 years. Our county board has been very good about recognizing the need of providing a high level of service to our citizens as far as being able to accept and dispatch 911 calls. They have been very good to the community by providing the funding that is needed, and we've been somewhat fortunate in finding some grant money to assist. It's a combination of the two that have probably made that possible. There's never enough grant money and there's never enough local money, but when you work them together and leverage one with the other, you get the job done.
Well, what about just with the geographic nature of Douglas County in northern Wisconsin, what kind of challenges do you see with that as it relates to fielding 911 calls?
The lack of cellular phone coverage makes it very, very difficult. And our cell coverage here really isn't that bad, but yet everybody expects their cell phone to work every time, every place, and it just doesn't happen. Depending on the carrier and the technology that carrier uses, sometimes we get the location of a tower, sometimes we'll get the tower and a vector off that tower, and then sometimes we get what we're supposed to get, and that's the lat long. And we've had our dispatchers pinpoint things within a matter of a few feet. We've had situations where we've had people lost in the woods, and they've called that person on the phone and told them to walk in a straight line in one direction and rebid to see which direction they're going, and was able to tell them, turn around and walk about a quarter mile the other way and you'll come out at a road. I mean, that's what it's capable of now if everything works the way it's supposed to, if the coverage is there and things like that. With the EzyNet, we'll even have enhanced information over that.
How prepared are other counties statewide? I mean, do you have any sense of how many counties have next-gen equipment like Douglas County does?
Bayfield County has next-gen equipment. In fact, they are our backup 911 center. We back each other up on both radio and 911. It's a situation where we each can't afford to have our own backup center, so we've worked together at costing a very minimal amount of money. We can get our 911 calls. If we had to leave this center, we could go over there and receive our 911 calls and actually dispatch our police and fire agencies from their center, and they could do the same from over here.
Through different surveys that have been sent out in the past, I think there's been a lot of misinformation from one county to another, which that's another part of the 911 subcommittee. Part of the tasks we've been tasked with is to gather all of that information so we know exactly what we are dealing with and where we can start the process of standardizing it across the state.
I believe that anyone that's bought an equipment probably in the last 5 years is pretty much ready for the next gen. It's just they can't get it.
So I guess what's the next step then? I mean, you talk about this subcommittee and the panel that's been set up. What's the goal or the hope for outcome? Is there a timeline as to when you would hope to see some of these things in place?
I don't want to put any words in anyone's mouth, but sooner than later, definitely. And I think the intent of it is that anybody can call on any device at any time and receive the same service. So that's the overall goal.
Bureau of Communications, when it was created, was placed under the Department of Military Affairs. And the Department of Military Affairs is very, very involved with emergency response and the protection of life and property and safety and whatever in the state. The Adjutant General is very actively involved, and to use his words, the things that are under the umbrella of this Communications Bureau, he says, failure is not an option. He wants to see things happen, and he would like to see them happen sooner than later. I believe there will be a tremendous amount of support at the state level for whatever the committee puts forth. And hopefully, after all the years and the work, the legislature, I believe, is somewhat sensitive at this point to recognizing we've done too little for too long, now we need to act. It's just, is the dollars, you know, are the dollars going to be available to pay for everything we need? And will there be the dollars at some point for grant money to help communities upgrade their equipment and to train and maintain their dispatch staff?
Because their budgets are already pretty thin and they can't afford to fund it on their own.
Well, with the tax freeze that's in place right now in Wisconsin, you know, I can't speak for all communities because there are communities in the state that have a lot of growth. And those communities with growth can raise their tax levy based on that growth. Our county and many of the northern counties, that growth rate is very small. So an example would be when we done our budget this last year, we every year have increases in personnel costs. There's people going through the step process. There's people advancing. There's health insurance and all these things. Our instructions from administration were absorb it. There are no increases. So if you have to absorb wage and salary increases and benefit increases, it's got to come from somewhere. And in our budget in Douglas County, there is money budgeted for maintenance and operations, but there is nothing budgeted on a regular basis or set aside for replacement of that equipment. We do have a bit of an equipment reserve right now in case something fails so we can have money to immediately replace it, but we don't have the hundreds of thousands of dollars that are needed when we start looking at replacing systems.
So how is the system right now for Douglas County? I mean, if we're talking about maintenance of equipment, I know you have, what, 9 or 10 towers now across the county? I mean, is that what you're talking about, or are you talking about things back here in the call center?
We're talking about the call center. The radio communications is another whole story, and we suffer the same things there. But again, our board has been pretty helpful with providing matching funds, and we've been very successful in getting grant money. We regularly work with cell companies in the state of Wisconsin where we can partner. We've had cell companies that have built towers for us and allow us to put our equipment on there. And in turn, they could be on the tower for a period of time without rent. And when that period of time is gone, then they start paying us rent on the tower they built. We've got at least 3 sites, maybe 4, with cellular companies. We also have 3 or 4 sites where we're working with the state. There's places our equipment is on state towers, places it's on cell company towers, and in return there's places state equipment's on our towers and cell companies on our towers.
So what kind of challenge does that pose having, you know, whenever you do have to upgrade equipment if you're working with several different, whether it's private or state entities?
Both the state and the cellular companies have been excellent to work with. Cooperation with their contractors for the cell companies, they typically have a project manager that we deal with. And there's paperwork, but it's not insurmountable. The state has been very, very easy to work with. We have memorandums of understanding. I think it's helpful that, you know, both Danny and I know a lot of people at the state level. But I think everybody in this business recognizes that if we work together, we can achieve the goal at a more economical rate and just be more successful by sharing sites. It also is good public relations. Nobody likes towers in their backyard. So if we can get our equipment and we get some cellular equipment and maybe got some state equipment all on the same tower, yeah, maybe the tower's a little bigger and a little stronger, but there's only one instead of 3. That makes the neighborhood happy.
Well, what is it that you really want to see happen or for the future of 911 service here in northern Wisconsin and Douglas County? I mean, is there anything aside from the staffing or maintenance that you really want to see happen for the area that would improve what, you know, the service that you're able to provide?
I just think seeing the infrastructure built out so there is consistency throughout the state would be nice to see, and to be able to utilize the equipment that we have in the back room. I mean, everyone's expectation of using their cell phone is that everyone's going to be able to find them, or they're going to be able to text if they can't talk, and it would be nice to be able to meet the expectations of the customer in the very near future.
The new standards that we expect that will happen don't scare me personally. Danny and our staff have really worked, and we feel that we are sort of ahead of the curve. Some of the things that we anticipate that are going to be implemented, we've been doing for years, and one of those would be the pre-arrival medical instructions. We've got that pretty well down pat.
What exactly is that?
Well, you call, and let's say little Johnny cut his finger and it's bleeding real bad, and Mom doesn't know what to do. Our dispatcher will talk Mom about how to put a pressured bandage on or how to hold pressure on it to stop the bleeding or whatever. CPR, someone goes down with a heart attack. Our dispatchers will provide CPR instructions over the phone.
But those aren't requirements of dispatchers right now.
They are requirements of our dispatchers, but they are not a state-mandated requirement. The state EMS board wants to see them as state-mandated requirements, particularly the CPR piece, but ultimately they would like to see pre-arrival instructions in every call center.
So what's been the obstacle to doing that in other counties or elsewhere in the state?
Money.
Money
to purchase this computer software to make it happen, or the flip charts to make it happen. Probably the biggest thing in small centers is having enough staffing, because when you do pre-arrival instructions, the goal is to keep someone on the phone until the ambulance arrives or until help gets there. Okay, in Douglas County, we have first responders, and we typically have a first responder on the scene in 5 to 10 minutes. But when you get out in the hinterlands of the county, it can be 30 and 40 minutes for an ambulance to arrive. If you're in a county that has a long response time, that dispatcher has to stay on the phone, and they are the only dispatcher in the center, the phone isn't going to quit ringing with other calls.
So it would be helpful to have more staff to answer other calls so you don't have to lose that person.
Correct.
And be able to walk them through it.
Yep, that would be correct.
It would also be appropriate staff. I mean, there's centers that have jailers that back up their dispatchers when they go on a break. And if that's a requirement, then every jailer that sits in that chair to answer a call needs to be certified, needs to be recertified, needs to be trained. So you're not just looking at a small center with a four-person staff. You're looking at the jail that backs them up that also needs to be certified. And that's a lot of money.
There are centers in the state where the jailer is also the dispatcher.
Is that happening here at all?
We have no part-time staff. All of our employees in our dispatch center are 100% dispatch staff and trained and certified in all the tasks that we require as a county, which is significantly more than is currently required at the state.
I imagine the state is aware of the staffing issue.
Mm-hmm.
So what's being done related to that?
At this point, research is about the only thing that's being done. There is no funding available to help that, or it's staffing the center is a local issue, and currently there are no mandates. There are things that we've done, or that Danny has done, using programs that are available to determine what the staffing levels should be, and I wish we could afford to have what that formula says, but we're doing a pretty good job with what we got.
Again, you were just listening to Danny Miller and Keith Kessler with Douglas County about efforts to upgrade 911 call centers and challenges facing emergency communication staff statewide. That's it for our program. You can hear it again online on our website at wpr.org/superior. You can also find us on our Facebook page at facebook.com/KUWSFM. Or you can find us on iTunes under Hear Me Out. I'm Danielle Kading, and you've been listening to Hear Me Out on Wisconsin Public Radio. We hope to have you back with us again next Friday. Until then, have a great weekend.